Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Forest fires are essential to the life and death of the wilderness. They have been for millions of years on Earth. It's only been since humans began settling in dense communities in rugged, wooded areas that the dangers to humans have emerged. Today, tens of thousands of Californians stand evacuated from danger zones in the early days of a fire season where the state's mountain snowpack is at its lowest level in 500 years. Well over 700,000 acres have already burned, but this story you're about to hear conveys how human communities have become tightly wrapped around our fragile ecosystems. Fires can destroy homes and cars, but leave communication systems intact. Paul Duncan is a battalion chief with Cal Fire who is living this experience. Called to fight the fire in his community, he left his family at home for the front lines, but was able to remain in communication with his family when he learned his own home had become the front line. With forest burning all around him, he directed his family's evacuation by cell phone. His wife, his son, and two daughters forced to flee in vehicles packed with just what they could grab.
I was at home with taking care of my wife, actually off duty in my home in Hidden Valley, and got a text from friends asking me what the status of the fire was. And I said, well, I'm at home with my wife taking care of her after her back surgery she had the day before. And I didn't know about the fire. So I opened up the door, walked outside, and saw a huge plume of fire coming off of Cobb Mountain where we used to live. And I told my wife that if she was good, I was going to call into work and say I was available if they needed me. And I did. I called into my supervisor and she said, absolutely, get into here. We need you. And I proceeded up to the fire line.
And what happened to your wife?
She remained on the couch. She wasn't supposed to be moving more than to sit up, stand up, and then lay back down after her surgery. And as I was fighting the fire, listening to our command channel, I heard that they were evacuating Hidden Valley, which is where we lived. I texted her that we're evacuating, and she said, okay, we're loading up. And I didn't hear much more from her. Little did I know, after I sent that text, within about 6 minutes, the back of our house was on fire, and they were fleeing for their lives. She left with one car loaded up with dogs, and my son left with his car, and our two daughters, ages 15 and 17, had our pickup. The two girls ended up driving through fire around burning cars to get to the north, and the road was still just barely passable. They were able to make it into the north. My wife came, started heading out, and she could not get out the way that the kids went out. She had to actually ram a fire gate that was closed in front of her with her car, and made it out to the main access road to see it was blocked to the north, and she couldn't make contact with the kids. She had to head south. She made about a mile before she was surrounded by fire on the roadway, and she placed a frantic call to me, asking me what to do, where she should go. She had fire all around her. What should she do? I gave her the advice that she needed to look at the lines in the road, see where they were pointing. She knew the road, and she needed to drive through the fire. And I told her at that point she needed to step on the gas, look straight ahead, and drive through the fire till she got to the other side, and that she would be okay. And then I had to hang up because I had structures and houses of friends that were burning in front of me. So I left her as she was driving through that, and the kids were able to make it north, and everybody met up much later that evening. I didn't realize our house was lost until the next morning about 8 o'clock, when I received a call from one of my chiefs at Cal Fire letting me know that the house had burned all the way to the ground.
Paul, what's it like to have the landscape of your home completely transformed like this in a matter of minutes?
It's a loss. It's a huge loss to to know that everything you've worked for the last 35, you know, 40 years is there's nothing left. It's just a heap. But when I was able to get into the house the next day and look at the utter devastation, I realized that other folks were in the same situation and that I had what was most important to me, and that was my family. That's something that's not replaceable. It's not stuff. It's not belongings. That is the most important things, is family, having my kids and wife all intact and healthy. And when I was able to meet them up with the next day, it was extremely emotional.
At any moment, any one of those kids could have made a wrong turn, and that would have been the end.
Yeah, I also sent a text to them because the girls were stuck behind cars that were burning and on fire. And I sent them the same text that I spoke with my wife, and that was, you need to drive, you need to pick the line, you need to drive through, and you need to drive all the way through the fire. You need to just step on the gas, look straight ahead, don't pay attention to what's going on around you, focus on driving, and you need to get out of there. And they did. My 17-year-old was doing a spectacular job of getting her 15-year-old sister, who was in the truck with her, both hysterically crying, was able to pull it together and find the fortitude to drive through that inferno. Just incredible.
Now, Paul, you're not seeing what they're seeing, right?
No, I'm not seeing what they're seeing.
You're telling them to drive straight ahead.
I'm telling them, well, I've been a firefighter for upwards of 30 years.
But still, Paul, you're not seeing what they're seeing. If you were wrong.
Yes. If I was wrong, then if they would have remained where they were, they would have been in more peril than they were. Knowing this fire, I knew that it was a wind-driven fire. I knew that it was narrow. I knew that it was that the fire front passes very fast, and what you're driving through are the sides of the fire. You're not driving through the head of the fire. And if you pass through the sides of that fire, you're driving through what we call a flank, and it's not very thick. It may look thick when you're coming up to it, but if you're driving through the side, it's only going to be about 50 or 75 feet of flame, and then you'll be in smoke.
What was it like not knowing? Because there was a moment where you had to wait and reconnect with them.
Oh, it was hours. It was trying. I just kept looking at my Find My iPhone app, because I have all the kids and my wife on that, and just trying to find them and to see where they had made. And it was an unbelievable relief when I was able to find out that they had made it into Lower Lake, which I knew was on the other side of the fire. It was an incredible moment of relief.
Paul Duncan is a battalion chief with CAL FIRE in Hidden Valley, California. For the thousands fleeing Syria's flames and bombs and chaos, the nation of Hungary has a response as of this week. Try and forcibly cross our newly constructed border fence and face prosecution. Tear gas and water cannon have also been used on migrants today by Hungarian authorities enforcing the now-closed border with Serbia. Arrest by Hungarian authorities, though, might feel more like sanctuary and an upgrade to hundreds of refugees currently trapped in a no-man's land between Hungary and Serbia. Joining me now from the Serbia-Hungary border is Lise Doucette, chief international correspondent for the BBC. Lise, is Hungary going to be able to turn this pathway into Western Europe a dead end?
Well, it certainly feels like a dead end, John. Yesterday, this last stretch of motorway was transformed into a place of protest, as hundreds of people who arrived there expecting it to be just another crossing on their way further north and west into Europe found themselves with a huge metal barrier slammed shut. And they started protesting, shouting slogans like, open, open, Europe. Europe, and even at one end where there was wire netting. And in a quieter tone, some of the migrants, most of them refugees there, said open to the Hungarian guards they could see. And the Hungarians looked back and shrugged and said, we lost the key. Now, overnight, that place of protest was transformed into really an open-air motel with people putting up tents, putting down bedding, bits of foil, paper bags, plastic, whatever they could find. And by morning, this early this morning when we visited, it was a tented village with about 60 tents there and some 2,500 people camped through the night. But it doesn't look like they're going anywhere. So many of them, and indeed we ourselves, are on our way to the western border of Syria towards Croatia, where people are now beginning to cross on foot from there.
What is the range of people you're finding among these migrants in terms of economic prosperity, their ability to travel, the conditions that they were leaving in Syria?
That is a big question, John. In fact, I think it is one of the most important questions now. I'm getting lots of people saying to me, Lise, these are not refugees. They're just economic migrants. Or other people saying, why are you calling them migrants? They're all refugees. Reality, especially when you're talking about a massive displacement of people, the biggest since the Second World War, doesn't fit into neat binary categories. And I can say from having watched this for the past few weeks, this human stream is really changing character and shape as the weeks go on. It seems clear, and UN officials confirm this, that it's still predominantly Syrian, but we're seeing growing numbers from two other war-torn countries, Afghanistan and Iraq, and we're also seeing people coming from countries where there really isn't a war, but there's a country which is failing in so many ways. And so we've met people from West Africa, even from places like Ghana. We've seen people coming from Pakistan. I said to one man, is there a war in Pakistan? He said, oh, the bombs are going off in Lahore. And yes, in the last few days, I've seen many Syrians coming from what I would regard as the relatively safe parts of Syria. No part of Syria is untouched by war, but they're coming from neighborhoods in central Damascus that I have visited many times. They're places where houses are still standing, where life goes on. But of course, it's a life where many Syrians believe they don't have a future. We've met Syrian families who've sold their house, sold their car, got on a plane, left the country, and are hoping to make a better lives for their children somewhere else. Even yesterday, late last night, as we were leaving the border crossing, one man came up to us and I asked where he was from. And he said, well, I'm Syrian, but I've been living in Dubai. And I said, Dubai? Why would you want to leave Dubai? And he goes, well, you know, I'm not able to make as much money there, but I'm going off to get a better life for my children in Germany. And they said, would you like to join us? We're going to cook some food now. Those are a minority, but I think we have to begin to ask, if a space is now opening up at last for those people destitute and desperate in need of a refuge, we can't have it that the people who need that refuge less or don't need a refuge in terms of the definition at all, we can't have those spaces closing. They must go to the people who need them to most, because those who need it the most desperately need them.
Lise Doucette, Chief International Correspondent for the BBC in the border zone between Serbia and Hungary and Croatia. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA Cref, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
So what is Hungary's official policy about the migration crisis, its border, and the building of transit camps for the people fleeing Syria? Zoltán Kovács is the Hungarian government spokesman. How many of the people on the border between Serbia and Hungary would you describe as asylum shoppers?
Well, that's what we exactly would like to know, and that's indeed why we have stepped up against illegal border crossing. It's the best interest of those genuine refugees that they could be differentiated from those who are coming only in the hope of a better life. Unfortunately, EU statistics show that the majority of those for the past year, 2 years, who applied for asylum somewhere in Europe were, as a matter of fact, these were economic migrants. So they were looking for a better life it was only a minority who was eligible for political asylum.
Mr. Kovach, in Syria, the civil war has gone on since 2011. I mean, isn't looking for a better life a reasonable expectation?
No, but that's indeed the point actually you made. Nothing happened for the past couple of months that would justify the sudden increase, the skyrocketing numbers of those who are arriving to Europe. Most definitely, living in a refugee camp or in a shelter next to Syria, in Turkey or in Lebanon, there are established ways of applying for asylum all around the world, including the Genève Convention back in 1951. The European Union has protocols as of the moment. Nobody keeps them, apart from Hungary. And what we see is a basically disorderly, undisciplined flood of illegal migrants entering the European Union. And indeed, once within the Schengen zone, they would really like to decide about where they apply for asylum. Now, that's against all international conventions and law.
Wouldn't you say, though, the Syrian situation is a unique set of circumstances that the Schengen protocols doesn't necessarily anticipate?
So bear in mind that these people try to travel through a number of countries. As a matter of fact, to reach Hungary, they have to travel at least four countries. And the first entry point, Greece, is already in the European Union. Obviously, there's no war, there's no prosecution. Though Macedonia and Serbia are not member states, but most definitely there's no war and prosecution. So obviously, it is a journey over 1,000 kilometers to the Hungarian border, which obviously questions the very nature of the journey. Are they genuine refugees taking an illegal way, paying lots of money to reach the European Union without discipline, this is again illegally, and apply for asylum wherever they want? And that's indeed a problem we are trying to face and address here.
Do you understand, Zoltan, that some might construe what you're saying as the only genuine refugee are people who have to be miserable before they come, having stayed in refugee camps, etc., that people who pay to get out of Syria in the middle of a civil war for whatever reason don't constitute real refugees? They have to be miserable to qualify in your terms?
Now, most definitely, and apparently there is a collision of, if you like, morality and the legal approach. But it is the best interest of those actually who are genuine refugees, whose life is in immediate danger, to be able to be separated, to be able to be differentiated from those, again, who are trying to misuse the European system. And again, imagine that situation happening in the United States. And I think that would really much take you closer, actually, to understanding what really is happening. In your country, you have probably the toughest migration rules and policy around the world. That doesn't mean that refugees who are really fleeing for their lives cannot come to the United States. And this is the thing, actually, what we believe that it's not only Hungary, but it should be the European Union in general, should be reestablishing. It is very unfortunate that for the past couple of years, the illegal way basically institutionalized reaching the European Union. It hasn't caused lots of problems and the drama up until figures and numbers started to skyrocket. Let alone Hungary has received over 200,000 illegal migrants this year. It's going to reach over 1 million around Europe. And it's completely unacceptable. It's completely unhandleable that these people come illegally. We don't even know who they are. So even if you state that they are coming from Syria, we can't check them because they come illegally. And it turns out that of the 200,000 people who have come to Hungary, less than one third even claim to come from Syria. And others are coming from more than 100 countries all around the world. That clearly indicates that what we are facing is not a refugee crisis. This is a mass migration crisis. And again, we have to address that accordingly. And I'm really sorry to say, but I feel like the moral standpoint, which has always been with us, and obviously we all see these personal or family dramas evolving in Hungary in front of our eyes, cannot be handled if the rule of law is not restored.
So you would prefer to have people drowning in the Aegean Sea than to have them welcomed in without the perfect paperwork that you describe here?
Well, that's a strange question, because that's exactly what we are trying to prevent. Again, you have to understand, people are not fleeing from Syria through the seas. People are coming from Turkey. And again, Turkey is a safe country, or at least a lot safer than Syria itself. So what you witness is that these people are risking their lives to reach a better life, or even if going for asylum. But still, it shouldn't be done. That's not the way.
Zoltán Kovács is the Hungarian government spokesman. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years, with services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
So I'll bet if you take some cute video of a pet or a family member and put your favorite pop song behind it and upload it, you kind of hope it goes viral and finds millions of watchers, and you become a famous legend, start a reality channel, and your life is set. That's the new American dream, right? Right? Well, who knows what was in the mind of Pennsylvania mom Stephanie Lenz when she recorded that toddler dancing video with 29 seconds of the Prince song Let's Go Crazy playing in the background. Her intention was probably not to start a federal case on copyright infringement, but she did. Universal Music Group accused the dancing baby video and Lenz of copyright infringement under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Lenz has maintained that the music in her video constituted fair use. She sued Universal for misrepresentation, and 8 years later, a three-judge panel has ruled unanimously in favor of Lenz. Joining me now with more is Ellie Mistal, an editor at Above the Law. Ellie, who's this a victory for besides Lenz?
How you doing? It is a huge victory for internet users everywhere and their babies.
Right. So fair. Now, in this case, it was playing in the background. She didn't take the music and mix it in as she might have done in iMovie or some, editing software. Is that different? Did the court distinguish between those kinds of uses?
Not exactly. Look, fair use is super complicated. I am a former lawyer who writes on the internet, and on a daily basis, I'm kind of winging it when it comes to fair use. The standard is very vague. It's very, are you using it in a way that it was intended to use? If you're doing that, then the copyright holders don't have an infringement case, right? That's the basics. That's the basis of it here. So, in the Dancing Baby case, the song is being used as it was intended to, i.e., a person is dancing to it. The music is not the focal point of the video. It's not an attempt to steal Prince's copyright to make your own derivative Prince Let's Go Crazy video. The focal point is the baby is, in the legal context, adding commentary to the Prince song, and that is, as we understand it, fair use.
Do the courts have anything to say, and does Universal, for that matter, have anything to say about the difference between a video that nobody sees and one that goes viral and that, 100 million people see?
Not really. I mean, you got to remember, there's a little bit. This case started in 2007, and back in 2007, the big Hollywood studios were doing this very manually. It's an intern at a desk looking, Googling things and trying to see if any copyrights are being infringed by their giant corporation. Now we do it through an algorithm, right? So it's an algorithm that Universal has right now that's sending out. They'll send out 1,000 takedown notices to Google, every few months based on what their algorithm shows up, and that algorithm doesn't really care how many views your YouTube thing has received.
Ellie, one of our listeners in Little Rock, Arkansas, says that any piece of music where the original creator and their children are deceased, grandchildren and so on are on their own, that should be free and should be available to anyone as a fair use. Is that a doctrine that you ascribe to, or is that relevant?
Yeah, not really. I get the thought process there, but again, I think that the fair use laws that we have are actually fairly going in the right direction, right? What we don't want is, I don't care if the guy's been dead for 50 years, we don't want you stealing somebody else's song and using it in its entirety and kind of passing it off as your own and making money off of it. Like, that's what we're trying to avoid. And the copyright holders do have a valid reason to basically want to protect their art at that level, even after they're dead. Eazy-E still should have copyright protection for his stuff.
How about However, Ben from Rochester Hills, Missouri, who wants Happy Birthday all his own? It's an American tradition. It's like copywriting Take Me Out to the Ball Game or My Country, Tis of Thee. Is Happy Birthday for free?
Yeah, that should be. That's always the weird one. I totally agree with Ben. That at some and again, we have in laws, like, at some point things do get into the public domain. Happy birthday not being in the public domain is a really weird one that should be there already.
We live in a controlled society. Happy birthday is not for free. Ellie Mistal is an editor at Above the Law and an editor at large of Breaking Media and ATL Redline. Thanks so much, Ellie.
Thanks for having me on.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like decluttering, drone photography, and duct tape crafting. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
It will be a trip back in time tonight when the top Republican presidential contenders hold their second televised debate. Not since 1976 has there been such a wide-open race for the White House for one party. And back then, it was for the Democrats.
I think this country has to come to terms with its limits and to make its choices. And a choice implies that you give up one thing and you take another.
We have better situations existing in race relations in Alabama than exist in many places in this country, and thank God for it.
If a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny.
Now I'm disturbed that the Democratic Party is becoming the party of abortion.
Whether our government will look after the interests of the average family or continue to protect the super rich and the giant corporations.
And if we can't implement international law, if we don't have enough moral courage to do that, I think we're in pretty bad shape.
Can you recognize the likes of Henry Jackson, George Wallace, Frank Church, Jerry Brown, Fred Harris, Ellen McCormick among the crowded Democratic field? Julian Zelizer is a historian at Princeton University and fellow at New America. He's the author of The Fierce Urgency of Now and Jimmy Carter. He reminds us that it was 17 Democrats who ran for president in 1976. And as he wrote in Politico, it was a crowded, wacky field that Zelizer says would rewrite the rule book for presidential politics.
In 1976, Democrats were eager to take back the White House. Richard Nixon had resigned. Gerald Ford had replaced Nixon. And Democrats were sensing that they could really be in power once again after all the problems the GOP had faced. And so a huge number of Democrats, about 17, jumped into the race, and they had a very contentious primary process where everyone seemed in.
And, you know, the question of who's the favorite and who's not was sort of up and down week to week, a little bit like what's going on now. Remind us of some of the narratives.
Yeah. So there were certain senators who were ready to move up, so to speak. And one representative, Morris Udall, who was a very prominent liberal, a big environmentalist. You had a senator, Henry Scoop Jackson of Washington, who was very liberal on domestic policy, but a hawk on foreign policy. And you had people like Frank Church, another senator from Idaho, who became famous exposing all the things that the CIA had done, like attempted assassinations overseas. And you had these members of Congress who were all part of the establishment, and they all thought that experience would count for a lot. So they all threw their name into the competition. Then you had a whole number of governors, many from the South, who also thought that this was a good time for them to run, including George Wallace, who had run many times before and tried to rile up the Southern populist wing of the Democratic Party at that time.
And what was so interesting to me is that, you know, so many of these characters, it feels like, looking back, this is their last shot. They're trying to redeem themselves for a moment of fame. I mean, in Scoop Jackson's case, I mean, he really goes back to the New Deal. All these people had reasonable expectations, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And it wasn't, you know, many people thought they would be the winners. And so when these people started to campaign at different points in the primary process, everyone expected that one of them would be the Democrat to be in the general election. And what no one saw coming was this guy from Georgia, Jimmy Carter, who put together a campaign which really understood the mood of the country, which really understood how the political process was changing. And Carter was ready to take on all these huge heavyweights who, as you say, saw this as their last chance and saw this as a very good chance for them to win.
Because, you know, Nixon had resigned, Ford was vulnerable. I mean, it was theirs for the taking. And yet, here's Jimmy Carter, who understood Iowa as much as he understood anything. Explain how Jimmy Carter's tactics in Iowa were really a huge deal.
Yeah, part of what had happened, Democrats had reformed the whole nomination process after the 1968 convention. And one thing they did was to break the power of the party bosses. So after 1968, it was clear that the nominee would be decided by caucuses and primaries. And no one took the Iowa caucus seriously. They thought it was this irrelevant part of the contest. There weren't a lot of delegates that come out of this. But Carter said, you know what? If I win, this is going to be the first contest of the whole series of battles that's going to take place. The media will start to present me as a front runner. And even if I don't win many delegates, simply getting the media to call me a front runner will help build momentum for the next contest in New Hampshire. And he understood the power of the media in the modern nomination process, and he understood how delegates wasn't the single goal that these candidates had to achieve. So he went into Iowa, he campaigned, he met with people, he went to every event possible where many bigger figures like, a church or Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana weren't even there. They weren't even taking it seriously. And he won. And the media said, this guy's for real.
If that's all Carter did, it would have represented a transformational moment in American politics. Politics was never the same after Carter won Iowa.
Absolutely. I think he was the first to understand how this nomination process changed, and he was the first to really set the template for how you campaign in the modern era. You're not meeting with party bosses anymore. That's basically his insight. Instead, you really want to court the coverage of your campaign, and at the same time, you want to put together a really great grassroots effort. You know, he had followers who are called the Peanut Brigade. They came in from Georgia to Iowa to New Hampshire. They met with people. They went door to door. They understood that, you know, retail politics was really extremely important once the party bosses at the convention were no longer making the decisions.
Ask the same question that a lot of people are asking when they look at the GOP. Who is the most maybe unsettling character to possibly emerge from that 17? Who is the strangest character who, if they'd been president, the world would have turned upside down back in 1976?
Well, obviously, some people would compare Trump not to Jimmy Carter, but to George Wallace, governor of Alabama. He had run several times for president. And what Wallace did was rile up the worst tendencies of his party. He subtly played by 1976 on the racial animosities that this country faced and other kinds of social tensions he capitalized on rather than trying to dampen them. Had Wallace somehow won, you know, you could argue that the country would be in horrible shape. And some would say that, you know, Donald Trump is playing to some of those tendencies. It's not just the media he understands, but it's understanding those elements of the electorate which really want to be mobilized around hate and anger rather than hope and optimism.
Julian Zelizer is a historian at Princeton University and a fellow at New America. He's the author of The Fierce Urgency of Now and Jimmy Carter. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Something to take with you today. Facebook may be getting a new button alongside like will be something else. But Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook chairman and founder, said this week it almost certainly will not be a dislike button. Quote, we didn't want to just build a dislike button where people were voting up or down people's posts. What Zuckerberg says they are working on is an ability to express empathy. Love that. Silicon Valley billionaire geniuses having trouble expressing empathy. Isn't that what the comments are for? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.